Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I am your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. And for this week's episode, I am rejoined by the team at the Bridging Heaven Retreat held at the Tandava Retreat Center in Mexico of Rack Razam, Quilly Powers, and Eugene Allende discussing their low-dose 5-MeO-DMT and meditation retreats. We kind of check in about how the first one went and what kind of feedback they got from that and what they're looking forward to with their upcoming retreats, as soon as is going to be actually coming up just in January, late January. So there's still time for you to get involved if you are interested and if this conversation inspires you. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and do some announcements first, shall we? So first off, let's issue some thanks and gratitude. Thanks goes out to Nick, who made a small contribution in support of this podcast via PayPal, which he's been doing fairly consistently over the past month or so for each episode he listens to. Thank you very much, Nick. Also, thank you to James, who has made his monthly contribution via PayPal, as he does every month. Thank you very much, James, for your continued and ongoing support. It is very much appreciated. And on the Patreon front, from this past week, I would like to thank Suhasini, who has joined up over as a patron over at my Patreon page, which is at www.patreon.com/martinwball. Thank you very much for your support there. And for anybody out there listening, this, of course, is a listener-supported podcast. If you would like to make a donation via PayPal or join up as a patron over at my Patreon page, just stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net and use either the PayPal or Patreon links at the top right of the page. And as I have been mentioning here on the podcast, of course, I ran out of storage space many years ago. And at this point, every time I upload a new episode, I have to delete an old episode. But those old episodes are migrating over to my Patreon page, and they are available for everybody who contributes at the level of $20 a month and up. So you get access to hours and hours and hours and hours of back episodes. If you want to catch more of the Entheogenic Evolution, just sign up over at Patreon at the $20 and up level. Whatever suits your budget best. Let's see. Also, very big, very exciting news for me. I'm happy to report that the audiobook for Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT, an Anthology of Approaches to Serving the God Molecule, is now live and available at audible.com, amazon.com, and the iBookstore. And also the album of original music that I created to go along with the audiobook is, of course, available out there everywhere that digital music is found. For one place, at my Bandcamp page at martinball.bandcamp.com, and of course at Amazon Music, YouTube Music, Spotify, Apple Music, all of those places, and that is the Pure Energy of Unconditional Love. It's a great album, and I definitely am getting a lot of positive feedback from listeners from that one, and hope that you enjoy it as well if you give it a listen. Let's see, what else have we got going on here? Of course, I am available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations to help you integrate your entheogenic experience from a non-dual and energetic perspective. I have availability this coming week, but then after that, taking a couple of weeks off to take a family vacation, and then we'll be resuming consultations in early January. But I do have a little bit of time this week that I could fit a few more people in. If you want information on that, just go to www.nondualentheogenicintegration.com. And coming up here on the podcast, we still have a few more chapters from the 2021 edition of The Entheological Paradigm, which is the audiobook that I completed before, the Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT audiobook. So that was number 10, and of course, Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT is number 11, but I still got a couple more chapters from the Entheological Paradigm 2021 edition to share on the podcast, and those will be coming in between interviews, and I have already 4 interviews recorded that are waiting to come out on the podcast, so that'll get us easily into January of next year, and of course, many more great podcasts to come. And as soon as we hit January, it will officially be 15 years old here, the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. 15 years of consistent output. How about that? Let's see. I think that's about all that I have to say in terms of announcements. So let's go ahead and get into the conversation with Rack Razam, Eugene Allende, and Quilly Powers. And their website is bridgingheaven.com if you want more information about their upcoming retreats and how you can participate and sign up. And I will just note that we did have this interview over Zoom. And what that means is that I don't have the ability to master and do levels for individual tracks. So it's the four of us all speaking together. So there's some audio overlap that takes place, and everybody's microphone is set at a different level. So there's some inconsistencies in terms of the volume, but that's what you get when you use Zoom. And anyway, we had a great conversation. This was held just a couple of weeks ago, and I'm happy to bring it to you here today on the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. So please enjoy. And of course, stay tuned after the interview, as I will be sharing one more track off of my new album, The Pure Energy of Unconditional Love. It's rather a long song, and it's actually my favorite song on the entire album. It's called Breathing in the Essence of Being, and, you know, just may or may not be related to the topic that we're discussing today. Anyway, so stay tuned for that after the interview. Enjoy.
Okay, well, today we're welcoming back onto the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast the team from the Bridging Heaven retreat series that is happening down in Mexico. We do not have Joelle Briere, unfortunately, in our group tonight, but everybody else is a returning guest here on the podcast. We have Rack, we've got Quilly, we've got Eugene. So we've got most of the team here. And tonight we're going to be talking about the previous iteration of the Bridging Heaven retreat. And we're going to get some of the information about how that went. We're going to be talking about what's coming up next for the team. It's been a few months since we've all spoken together. So I thought maybe we could just kind of quickly go around the circle and just do a quick check-in and see how everybody's been over the recent months. And then we'll get into the subject of the microdosing of 5-MeO-DMT and meditation in the retreat. So who would like to jump in first?
I'm good. I'm the same. I'm Rack Rozanne. I don't change much. Just perennially Rack Rozanne. Thank you.
But what, no mention of the dental work?
No.
Well, hello, everyone. Eugene Allende here, here in Northern California, just enjoying the fall weather and just waiting for that water still to come. And yeah, happy to be here, an honor to be with these beautiful folks. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here, Eugene. Quilly, how are you?
I'm good too, although I miss the light of summer. It's cool here and dark. It's already dark out. So, It's been a really nice time since the retreat. And one of the remarkable things is that we have this thread on Signal and everyone is still connected in the that was in the retreat. And I really appreciate that. And not just superficially, you know, really deep reports of things that are going on. So that's really rewarding.
I'd like to add to that, it is rewarding because it feels like this isn't just a retreat or a platform that we're building with Bridging Heaven. You could say it's a movement, you could say it's a family. It's essentially a community, right? And so, yeah, as Quilly said, part of this is that we are connected with the participants that went on retreat with us, and we're continuing to deepen that relationship with their practice. So we're not going away, and that we are checking in, and we are in some ways holding them accountable to have that discipline to continue their practice and continue to reveal what the medicine and what their own meditation capabilities have shown.
Excellent. And I will say that I did hear from one of the participants at the first Bridging Heaven retreat, and his review was that it was exceptional. He said he just had a fantastic time. He loved connecting with all of you and with everybody else there, and said that the practices and the engagement were, he just said it was everything that he was looking for, and he just spoke very, very highly of it. So he was a very happy participant.
You know, it's been an incredible journey because it truly is a marriage in heaven, right? Of really bringing these two modalities together to really explore the nature of who and what we are. And as we begin to sort of mature into that realization, I mean, first is the peak experience. You peak into that deeper foundation and ground of who we are. But what we were sort of moving towards, it's how to really track yourself back to that realization moment to moment. And that doesn't just happen with medicine, that happens with these practices. So yeah, I just want to kind of piggyback how exceptional that that retreat was, and just to see how people really began to resonate with that deeper reality that's within all of us, that deeper unified field. And that towards the end of it is very clear that we were all basically expressing from that same source, that we were all in a sense entangled, to borrow quantum physics lingo there. We were entangled so that we were all kind of feeling each other towards the end. As you can imagine, the practice grounding us back into it, but then the molecule opening us towards that realization, and then to really ground it into that permanent trait, as Kim Wilber called it, from state to trait, to really make it the default mode of our experience in life. So taking it off the default mode network, which we're identified as the neural networks that maintain the ego, once you begin to turn that off, both systematically through the practices, but also by including these incredible molecules, we can begin to access a deeper center of gravity for the experience in life, which is the Jivanmukti or the Bodhisattva ideal, where we are embodying that pure awareness. So really, to bring it from conceptual theory to actual practice was just an incredible thing to be a part of.
And let's do a quick check-in with 3D space and time. So we're recording this right now on November 21st. And it was obviously some months ago that we did the first interview on this topic. When precisely was that first retreat? Just so we can all have that frame of reference, especially with the idea that people are still connecting and still participating since then.
Yeah, so if your listeners haven't caught the first interview we did back in May 2022, the first bridgingheaven.com retreat was July, first week of July 2022 in Tepotzalan, Mexico, at the Tandava Retreat Center run by Joel Briere in Victoria. And maybe just an overview if that people don't remember. I mean, the whole conceit or focus of the retreat is to work with low-dose 5-MeO. We have utilized the emerging technology of the 5-MeO vape pens, which is a whole other subject, but is really starting to proliferate in the underground, and there's issues around the correct usage and set and setting of that delivery mechanism. But what we discovered, I think, is pens are awesome. Again, it's really about the container. Thank you, Mom. It's really about the container, as with any medicine, of the usage, and that they can be an incredibly efficient delivery mechanism for sublimated, sort of like ingestion of the medicine. So the idea with Bridging Heaven was to explore, as we've said, this marriage between the meditation maps and modalities and the medicine of 5-MeO. There's one key study that has been done, which I can provide in the links as well, which was looking originally quite a few years ago at EEG maps of people on the medicine and then comparing them to EEG maps of meditators meditating. And essentially what it showed with both cases was identical brainwave mappings of hypercoherence in the brain and essentially a gamma state. So, you know, a lot of times when people, especially science, is looking at 5-MeO, they will just do the neuroscience and the brain maps and look at what's happening. But to compare it to the meditation brain maps is very crucial and opens up a whole new area of understanding that these are two different pathways into the same interface of the egoic mind and of lowering that egoic mind. So what we see, you know, overarchingly with 5-MeO culture in general, when it's maybe you could say a peak experience or done at a retreat or done in a shamanic or therapeutic set and setting, is that you go along and you have this experience of external 5-MeO modulating your ego consciousness and revealing the divine within. It is a revelation because the neuroscience is showing all 5-MeO really does is lower the electrical activity, frontal and parietal lobes, default mode network maybe as well, but it's lowering the egoic structure and revealing what's underneath. In that experience, a lot of things can be happening at the same time. There can be a catharsis. There can be the emotional release, sort of trauma repair. There can be awareness of all different aspects of yourself and all of space-time. So it's busy. There's a lot that's happening. And essentially in this classic 5-MeO experience, the wisdom is to surrender, to let go. And part of the journey of that discovery is learning how to let go. And if there's any armoring or trauma blocks or reasons why we don't feel comfortable in letting go. So, you know, you see a lot of diversity in everyday 5-MeO settings of people that essentially either armored and contracted or open and able to let go. And then the medicine will work with that. With this retreat and with the meditation style, Bridging Heaven is essentially a five-day meditation retreat. It's a meditation retreat. You know, we'll talk about this a bit more of the rollout and what we did. But essentially, it's every day meditating for long stretches without breaks, keeping in noble silence, in a way, letting go of the pollution or sort of cleansing the mental pollution of our everyday interactions in the egoic state, which might mean talking to other people, engaging with other people, bringing them back to the mind. So the retreat for 5 days is a container and a set and setting of a meditation-style retreat where you are encouraged to be and to sort of lower that mind. And there's a lot of meditation practice and instruction around that. As a boost or an enhancement on top of that, there are set times within the meditation practices where the low-dose pens are utilized and you're meditating, the bell will ring, and then low-dose 5-MeO. And when I say low-dose, I've got to say personally, it was lower than I even do with handshakes myself with toad medicine, which is another variable with dosage. So part of me and my ego self was always like, it never quite even got to where maybe the handshakes for me. And I have strong handshakes, like 20 milligrams toad. But there's a lot of learning and a lot of knowledge and a lot of awareness of the ego and its cravings and desires on those levels. But the low dose essentially was perfect for sublimating, enhancing the meditation practice. So the overarching thing I got from this was, it's 180 degrees different from a normal 5-MeO experience. It's not about letting go. It's about being present. You may let go in that presence, but you're actually sort of practicing that edging where you're recognizing all the facets of consciousness, all the ego desires and aversions, all the little nuances. It's very, very nuanced. And within that, it wants you to be present to learn from those nuances. So really, this is like a hyper acceleration of the meditation path, and it is the marriage of the practices, the modalities, the entrainments of meditation with the hyper coherence that the 5-MeO can bring with the practice. Yeah.
So we didn't actually teach a particular meditation practice. I've been practicing Buddhism for years, a Theravada Buddhism, and Eugene has an eight limbs of yoga practice. And, you know, so the actual thing that you do with your mind, we kind of expect a person to come with a practice that they're going to do. We're not insisting that you follow your breath or you know, anything like that. And I do this practice myself weekly and have been now for over a year. And I'm learning that there are things that you can only learn from meditation. Like you don't really learn discipline, for example, from doing 5-MeO. You don't learn renunciation. You don't, there's things. And interestingly, I surveyed all of the leaders at the retreat afterwards, and there's a certain way of collecting the mind or concentrating the mind in samadhi, and the beginning stages of that, the first four, I don't think it's possible to get there without meditation. It's like when you take the medicine, you jump into these very advanced, spacious aspects of concentration, and that is such a reward because it feeds back to your meditation practice and rewards you for doing those basics. But I think that the stability And access to those higher forms requires that meditative ability. I'm finding that in myself. And I just had I just am barely off of a meditation retreat that I did. And my first entry, like on day three, which often takes me a lot much longer than that to get into some of the higher states of practice, I went right into a very, very similar experience that I would have on five with medicine, without any medicine. And I was just sort of stunned by that, really, because I was able to let go. And what Rack was saying about, there is a little bit of difference. It's not exactly letting go on this retreat. It's staying in awareness and letting and allowing. And there isn't a letting go within that, but it is also, you really want to stay present. And I just would add that the people with the more meditation experience used less medicine. And I think that's an interesting observation. Like I see that happening also even after Eugene and I have done the integration follow-up with everybody. I think we both did three interviews with half the people. And the people who do a lot of meditation, you know, they'll make a practice out of using a pen or a low dose of the medicine, but not really often. There was a guy on this morning on our thread who has been preparing to use medicine again and had a profound experience. So it's kind of exciting to see all the different ways that people are using it and allowing their person to come through. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this is a really fascinating distinction that you guys are making between sort of this goal of letting go, which we all know is very valuable, especially the higher the dose, the more you can let go, the better it's probably going to turn out for you. But cultivating these other skills, these meditation skills, such as presence, such as focus, because I think that when we can wed presence and focus with letting go, then you're going to get even more out of your experience. But what you're talking about at these lower levels, of cultivating these skills. And I think it's really interesting that I know a lot of people, when they first start a meditation practice, there's some things that happen where people, they might start to just fall asleep. So again, it goes back to focus and presence and awareness, or people can get very uncomfortable. People can start to get nervous, actually, if they're just starting to enter their mind for the first time through meditation. They're like, whoa, there's too much going on here. Or then also, you know, the Zen monkey mind description of when you get in there and you realize, oh, I'm just jumping from one thought to another, to another, to another. So you see these meditative faculties then as really contributing to people to be going deep into their meditation, just with the little adjunct of the five MEO. Is that a correct description of what you guys are seeing?
Yeah, yes. And if I can jump in here real quick, I just want to unpack what we're calling presence. If the listeners or us here in this conversation, take a moment and just act as that which is aware and present within us. What do we notice? Number one, we notice that presence itself, awareness itself, is formless. Number two, we notice that presence or awareness is ever present. It doesn't come from anywhere. It doesn't go anywhere. It's ever present. Therefore, it is timeless. It is only when it enters the mind, the individual mind, that it diffracts into a sense of yesterday and tomorrow. But awareness itself is fundamentally timeless. Three, awareness itself has no space, no location. It is non-local. We can rip into a brain. We won't find awareness. We can rip into the body. Awareness is spaceless, timeless, and formless. And here's the big one, the fourth one. If we really rest in that which is aware, now we're not even talking about medicine, we're just talking about our direct experience in this moment, you can recognize there's only one of it. There's only awareness. And that's only when awareness limits itself in a subjective individual mind that it creates the other, that it creates diversity, it creates the world of objects. So samadhi, when we talk about samadhi, it's really when there is no subject because there is no object. Subject and object, merge into one, which is the definition of nirvikalpa samadhi, which is pure presence, pure awareness. Now, in meditation, what we practice is we quiet the individual mind, the thoughts, right, which coagulate to create the construct of the self. But once all that quiets down, we can access that pure awareness in our own deepest sense, because it's the nature of mind. Now you add something like an entheogen, particularly 5-MeO, and it'll dissolve that conceptual construct that we call the self. And all those thoughts go away. So we have full, brilliant access to the pure luminosity of that which is aware. But what is important to remember is that we are that, right? We are that awareness moment to moment. So what these tools are doing, these are just methods. And if we remember Ram Dass, all methods are traps. Right? We don't want to be a meditator. We want to be free. We don't want to be a medicine person. We want to be free. We don't want to be a Buddhist. We want to be free. And what does freedom mean? Is to learn how to abide in that which is aware, that which is present. Because if we really rest in it, we are the timeless. We are the spaceless. We are the one. Now, what's interesting is that individual nervous systems partake of that one consciousness. They receive the consciousness, filter it through the individual nervous system and express the individual we are. But if we really turn those filters off, whether through meditation or through medicine, what we can appreciate is what we really are, which is this vast, formless, infinite being. And that then shows up into the world. But it shows up into the world with a certain healing, with a certain capacity to inspire, to empower and to activate the transformation that we're seeking as a planetary whole.
And I think that that's a really great distinction to make between sort of the individuated awareness with the collection of the sense of me and my perspective versus the presence and awareness that you're describing here, this non-local, non-spatial, infinite unitary awareness. And I think kind of speaking with these terms can help people understand why when many people first encounter 5-MeO DMT, as we all know, a lot of people go through a whiteout, or they might go through a blackout where the ego is there and the ego says, oh, something is happening. And then later the ego comes back and people often describe themselves as waking up or becoming conscious again. And it can be really baffling for people who have those experiences to say, well, actually, if you just reside in presence and awareness, your awareness goes all the way through the experience, opens up to the infinite, and then you can watch the ego come back on. And you're neither going into a whiteout or a state of unconsciousness, and then you're not returning to consciousness. What you're actually doing is disengaging from the ego and then re-engaging from the ego. But awareness can actually flow through all of that. And I think that's probably that the meditation can help people through that process of learning to how to disengage from the individuated awareness into this more universal presence.
I think that's exactly it. Like, yeah, as you say, the white out, I think did you coin that term? That as part of our culture that people do experience that when it's like the ego can't handle the intensity, it just goes. But that's the way we've been thinking of it from this side, you know, going in. But in the Sanskrit and in the Vedic maps, when they say nirvikalpa samadhi, it is that absolute oneness. But it's like the individual drop can't remember the oceanic consciousness because it's not no longer there. But what I think that implies as well is that, you know, who knows how many people have done 5-MeO by now? It's going to be in the hundreds of thousands, maybe even the millions. I do not know with the scaling networks. But, you know, I had an article that came out on my website a few weeks ago called Samadhi Mesh Networks. And it's this idea of what is the aggregate? What is the collective shift, or what is happening when so many of us are activating with 5-MeO? And so many of us are having these peak experiences and maybe the full release, and then maybe even the nirvikalpa samadhi. But the nirvikalpa samadhi in psychonautical understandings of a whiteout is almost like a disappointment. It's almost like that we don't remember, and the ego on this side of the veil is always like, oh yeah, you explain to them, well, that's a nirvikalpa samadhi. That's the ultimate pinnacle of the Vedic meditation samadhi path. And people are like, oh, I don't remember. You know, it's like, oh, I want my money back. You know, but they've got a point in the sense of if you just get helicoptered up to the top of the mountain, you don't really appreciate the rigor and the gains. You don't build the muscle yourself. So if you come back to a meditation practice and you are building up to a samadhi state, a unity state, a oneness state, or even a nirvikalpa samadhi state, you presumably have more, let's say, muscle training or more resilience to be able to both surrender to it and embody and encapsulate it. So then I think you appreciate it more. The issue, of course, is there's no guarantees with a lifetime of meditation you'll ever, you know, succeed in a samadhi state. What I've noticed as well in this short retreat and the gleanings, and I must say it's a whole deep other pool of knowledge and almost like world which parallels psychedelics and definitely overlaps, but it's a whole nother body of commitment to go down this path, right? But there are such intricacies where you can entrain your consciousness and build up to that moment. But along the way, you also discover all these like really subtle perhaps blockages. Like in the West now, there is such a focus on trauma and PTSD and healing with psychedelics across the board. In some senses, totally understandable. I'm all for that. And yet that's not all these substances do. They just find that people with trauma, it can help essentially because the mind or the ego mind goes offline and the cork comes off the bottle and trapped energies can be released. And yet there's always more. It's not the fine tuning detail. So, you know, as you go into these states of being in these samadhi states, whether through meditation or medicine, you may encounter what they call the samskaras, like habits or patterns or formations, which are sort of gnarly and knotted. And you're doing your progress, but then you come across this stuff. And in the medicine, it's very difficult to have the discernment to know what's going on. In the meditation styles where you're perhaps acclimatizing into it, you know, I mean, there can be flashes of intuition and inspiration where you understand everything and what's happening to you at once. But it's the fine details of unraveling and unknotting, which I don't think psychedelics appreciate. It's like a bludgeon in a sense. For the PTSD and the thing, it's like, let's up the dosage. Let's try this psychedelic. We're going to like, you know, burst through all those blockages. When in fact, yes, you can do that. And maybe that is necessary on some level, but it's the fine details, the ingrained habits, which persist and come back when the ego comes back after the peak experience. But I'm sure both Quilly and Eugene could talk a lot more about the samskaras and the fine level detail that this can support.
Well, we humans, we like what's pleasant and we like to get rid of what's not pleasant. And both psychedelics and meditation teach us a form of equanimity, of recognizing it's all of this is both good and bad, pleasant and unpleasant things are going to happen to us. And to learn to not get tossed around by that, to be able to be steady and balanced with how it comes like that. And so when you're sitting in meditation, when these difficult times state, that happens to be your egoic work, your psychological work, and with the addition of medicine, you can open to those. If you can open to those, that facilitate with this medicine, no, many people will not open to it, but we, with time, maybe they can. So to learn that, whichever mode you're doing, or even both, it's tricky. It's a gradual opening and awakening to allow those individual habits to become our assets, because we're all unique. And I don't need to be just like Rack, even though I'd love to be able to speak like that, but we got Rack to do that. So, you know, to really allow ourselves to be fully ourselves and open, that's when the juicy part of life really starts to happen. And you know, one thing that I came away from the retreat thinking we needed to emphasize a little more is the ethical piece of it. And Eugene's system has, I don't know if it's the first limb or the second limb, but it's the ethical limb. And I think it's, we didn't really put this forth so much. And in my lineages, we have a set of precepts that are non-harming and, you know, to teach us to use right speech and such things. And I think, you know, we aren't going to wake up and become good human beings as long as we're not speaking kindly to people. Or, you know, I think these, to have a big ethical foundation, a deep ethical practice that one works with regularly is a really important foundational to both medicine work and meditation.
If I can jump in here and just kind of going off of what my colleagues are mentioning. So these, as we know, these medicines have incredible potential for healing and so forth. But if you put a little bit of preparation before the medicine, what you can achieve is it's much deeper. So what do I mean by that? So our program has three prongs. We've already mentioned meditation and the medicine. But the third is the eight limbs of yoga, which is the system for completely reprogramming and reorganizing the nervous system so that it can receive powerful energies, cosmic consciousness. So Patanjali, who was the sage 2,500 years old, who put together all these practices designed to prepare the nervous system to receive this experience, the full release. In those days, maybe it was soma, but it was also just based on their inner practices. So the eight limbs is the basic framework that we work with. Just to go through it really quickly for the listeners, the yamas are what Quilly was talking about. It's the ethical principles of a good life, being truthful, not killing, not stealing, etc. These cultivate the set in the set and setting, right? The set of the mind. It prepares the mind to open to things. If you stole or you were mean or you were killing some living being, that will pollute the ability to open into this divine awareness. Number two, niyamas. These are the cleansing practices, eating well, not polluting your mind with random useless media, but reading the spiritual text, prepping and priming the mind. And in our course, we have these sanghas. These talks where we kind of prime the mind to be tuned to those ideas, right? Which also helps. Then of course, the third are the asanas. You open the body, you stretch the nervous system and the limbs so that energy can move through you freely, right? If you're all scrunched up and you have pain here and there, then that's gonna come up in your session. As we know, trauma lives in the neuromuscular contractions of the body. So as you open it up with your asana practice, you necessarily begin to already release the traumas that are locked in the body. Fourth, pranayama, the breath work, again, moves the subtle energy in the body, prepares the system, purifies the nadis and the system to again receive this energy. And the last four limbs are the practice of meditation within the yogic system, which are Pratyahara, looking inward, which this is the meditation, right? And when we do the medicine, it's all about looking inward with the medicine. Dharana, which is finding a still point, right? The mind, as we know, if we go in, the mind is all over the place. It's the drunken mind, monkey mind, right? So we find a point to just still the mind, to bring it back over and over so that you train the mind to settle before you even take a hit. You train the mind to be quiet and still. And this is your training, the muscle, as Rack pointed out, the spiritual muscle. Dhyana is the state of meditation, which is now a communion between you and the divine. You're not fully one with it, but you are beginning to resonate with a deeper potential within the human experience, in which ultimately blossoms into samadhi, which is pure awareness, where the subject, which is your own individual perspective, dissolves. And it dissolves into that equanimous white light that we all so much love with the full release, right? So you are able to kind of be with that, but you've already prepared. You've done all the preparatory work to be able to open to this full experience, without any hesitation, any resistance. So it's much smoother. Without the preparation, sure, you may hit the jackpot, but most likely not if you haven't followed the ethical principles, if you haven't worked with your body, if you haven't opened the system. You're going to confront the stuff before you hit the light, right? So the eight limbs prepares the system so that you can easily and smoothly open to your deepest potential, which is that pure awareness.
Something I wanted to jump back into. Quilly, actually, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Quilly. Go ahead.
Wanted to get Joel's name in there because he's a really great asana teacher and pranayama teacher, and we did that every day before we actually did any practices, any others.
Yeah. Well, thank you for mentioning Joel there. Of course, again, for the listening audience, he's part of the team, but he's not able to be with us on this call today. But Quilly, I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned before, because it's something that came up in a consultation with an individual last week, and I thought it was kind of an interesting question. I had my own way of answering it, and I just wanted to throw it out to you guys here. So the person had not experienced 5-MeO, but she was considering having a 5-MeO DMT experience. But she said, well, you know, all this non-duality stuff and all this equanimity stuff, so isn't it kind of boring? Like if we're all just this unitary consciousness and being, and if we all realize that, then doesn't it mean that we're all just going to be the same? And isn't that just kind of like the McDonaldization of the entire world, where every culture is the same and everybody speaks the same language? Isn't that what this is going to do to us? So she had some resistance around this question of kind of if it's all about the unitary being, well, what about my individuality and everybody else's individuality? So I'm curious how you guys would respond to an inquiry like that.
Well, it allows more space to be able to actually get in there and enjoy it when you're worrying about how to get more and how to push away. You're busy and you think you're really enjoying, say, the chocolate cake, but if it comes to you, it doesn't. Equanimity does not mean you don't enjoy, or you get to still enjoy. You just allow it its freedom, and you're not, you know, clinging to it as a source of ongoing pleasure. When the chocolate cake is gone, it's gone, and then you're there to the next thing. In my direct experience, both on medicine and meditation and in life in general, the more equanimous I become, the more I'm able to really intensely engage in whatever I'm doing.
So you see it as enriching.
I do.
You know, and it's also, I'm sorry, go ahead, Quilly.
That was it.
You know, there's this concept in the Indian philosophy. There's the inward moving path and then the outward. In Advaita, it's all about moving inward and peeling the onion, the layers. It's basically starting, I am not this body. That which is aware is not that which it is aware of, the body. Then you go into the thoughts. I am not those thoughts. That which is aware is not what it is aware of. So you move into that equanimous, spacious oneness. But then there's the tantric path, which once you've rested in that oneness, then you turn back towards the world. You turn back towards your mind, towards your ego, towards your body, towards your community. But now there's something different. Now you're just not stuck in the whim of the mind, of the drunken monkey mind, right? The ebbs and flows of desire of the sensual world. Now you've touched something that feels like freedom. You've touched something that is beyond the suffering of the world, which gives you the groundedness to be able to face the world. But now you return to the individuality, but now with a secret gnosis, with a secret knowing of who you really are. You're still in the world. You're still in the ups and flows of life and enjoying and with the pain and all of it. But if you cultivate this non-dual awareness where you realize that you're one and the many or the individual at the same time, then you have a little bit more capacity to be a wizard, to be an artist, to be co-creator in this incredible journey through life. You're not so much conditioned and pushed and pulled by outside authorities. You begin to tune to an inner sovereign knowing that is unshakable, and that is your refuge and it is your ground. And from there, you go back to your world and to your life, but again, with a new balance, a new understanding.
I think it reminds me of questions you've posed, Martin, when we've had discussions like this. You know, like, is God lonely? It's like, what's the point of going out there and realizing it and then coming back here? I think we are still approaching the divine from the ego state. It's like saying, well, if we get to, you know, unity consciousness and oneness, isn't that just homogenization? It's like McDonald's. Is that the best comparison for the divine state we have? I mean, you know, the map is not the territory, so you can read about 5-MeO, but the feeling of connection to your true nature and who and what you really are, the glory, right, of the kingdom that lies within is worth seeking and is worth remembering. And then as we come back from that, we are different. So it's like we've got it 180 around the wrong way. It's like we're actually the divine having the human experience. If we can remember the divine in the human vessel, then we're radiating the divine. And for me, this is sort of the only edge I find left in 5-MeO culture, is that as it's rapidly absorbed into the psychedelic, you know, corporadelic therapist model, 1 hour, 2 therapists, cure your smoking and anxiety and resolve your issues with your mother. Meanwhile, you're going to God in unity consciousness. But it's like, all right, what it reveals to me, and I don't think science hasn't joined the dots yet, because they're so reductionist and looking at what it can do in the therapeutic model, which is embedded within capitalism, they're looking for tools for the relief of ego states. What we're saying with 5-MeO is not only does it dissolve the ego is reabsorbed back into the oceanic oneness of consciousness, right? And I mean, this is just, it's so freaking big that we're trying to reduce the effect into something we can digest and understand. It has its own agenda. If this truly is a geography of the divine in all of us and all living things, then the intelligence in that divine geography is, I believe, grooming the vessels. So as we know, we talked about the Jivan Muktas in India and the enlightened ones and traditions which have supported in their cultures people going inwards with either meditation or the soma or the marriage of the two again in previous archaic cultures. And all of it is entraining us to remember this, not for the ego to remember its God, right? Because really, again, we're still one step on this side of the veil looking at the divine. Really, it's the divine within looking through and going, I'm now playing the role of Rakrazan or Eugene or Quilly or Martin, right? It's like, so that McDonald's franchise model, yeah, it's a global franchise called humanity, right? We've all got it. And the golden arches of the kingdom are shining and radiating the truth of their being. But it implies to me that intelligence has a plan and that it can step into the vessel. And if it steps into a vessel which is compatible and has done the work to get out of the way, the ego is never really lost, but it's sublimated back into an interface with the oceanicness that is present at all times. And this changes everything. I don't know if this is possible, but I can see the contours of the next few steps where it could be possible. And I think it's worth working towards. So that's really what we're doing. Essentially, Bridging Heaven is a mystery school in a retreat format, which is in training and supporting and nurturing the divine within, not the human to remember the divine, but making the vessel clean and pure enough to remember the divine that it can come in and have its relationship with the human facade. I think that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And Quilly, did you have something you wanted to add?
No, I think you got it.
Okay.
Coming back to the retreat experience, though, there, our egos are what we're bringing to the cushion and to the medicine, and that's how we walk in. And so it's not the experience of taking something that's a negative experience and trying to open around it. You have to actually experience the spaciousness of equanimity, and that's a gradual process. So you experience, say, on medicine, and then you come back, and you know you're still having troubles with your mother-in-law, and you know you've opened to it in a certain way, and maybe it's just a little bit looser. So I think it's a very practical thing. Both of these paths are very practical. They change your daily life. Maybe not overnight. Medicine does more than, you know, some people come out of a medicine experience and their life has changed. But, you know, it's still a gradual shift in your everyday life if you don't continue to work it. So I think that's really what we're doing, yeah.
And it's the beauty of the container of the silent retreat gives the person the opportunity to really look at their inner life. And we're talking about the ego as if it was an entity, but you begin to realize that there is no entity there, right? The ego is a process. So that the more you educate yourself from identification to that process, which we call ego, you begin to see that it's much more fluid and ephemeral than we once thought. So ego is what we do, and meditation is who we are, to quote Rupert Spira, right? Let me repeat that. Meditation is what we are. Ego is what we do. So ego is not an entity. It is the process of the mind looping around itself. So when we give it space, we give it silence, we give it stillness, we can actually begin to notice the patterns that begin to come to the surface. The patterns that no longer serve us, the patterns that are contracted, that are angry, that are sad, right? This is where the therapeutic piece comes in, is that you're able to access a deeper identity, that of presence and awareness. And within that field, you get to do some inner engineering, right? Release those patterns that you no longer want to reinforce, and then reinforce the patterns that you want to strengthen, such as focus, such as presence, such as concentration, etc. So that's kind of what Rack talks about, the entraining of the brain, right? How to bring those neural pathways and how to really wire the brain towards those deeper states of wholeness and well-being that are at the highest of the human potential that Maslow talked about. So this is really an experience that is available to all human beings. But what we're doing in this retreat is actually really bringing the most advanced tools known to humanity, bringing them together, both the eight limbs of yoga, the meditation practice, and the medicine, to really facilitate inner growth and inner awakening.
So, Eugene, you just mentioned a key word that I don't think we talked about last time, because actually the person that I mentioned before who went to the retreat, I recall now that he said, oh, and I wasn't expecting it to be mostly a silent retreat, but it was. So maybe we could talk a little bit about silence. So let's enter some irony into the picture. Let's talk about silence and the importance of silence and what role that plays within the retreat.
Well, you know, I think Quilly has a lot to say about silence coming out of a silent retreat. But, you know, the silent, I mean, because whenever we have a conversation, that information goes into the brain and it excites the mind, right? This conversation is incredibly exciting to me right now, right? So it's stimulating all these thoughts and ideas. Every time you come into contact with another human being, there's an exchange, and that exchange creates waves in the mind and the consciousness. But what we're exploring here is what lies behind the excited mind. What happens when mind comes to rest? And here's something that I like to say, which is kind of fun. Mind is awareness in motion. Awareness is mind at rest, right? So that when awareness is in motion, we have mind. And then when mind is at rest, it's pure awareness. Now that's the non-duality of it, because if the mind are the waves, the ocean is awareness. so that even when you're having thoughts, ultimately it doesn't matter because those thoughts are made out of awareness. So it's all awareness in the end. So with the silence, we get the opportunity to really explore what happens when we allow the mind to settle, when we bring the mind to one point so that it becomes still, very still. And then you apply the molecule once you've already entered that state of stillness. See, that's the real interesting piece, the leading edge piece of this retreat is that you've done the meditation, you've done the yoga, now introduce the molecule. What happens then? So the potential for awakening is exponentially available.
I think I'd just like to add, both Quilly and Eugene were exceptional teachers and leaders, as was Joelle and Victoria, his partner, who were on Bridging Heaven. But I must say, Quilly, as almost like a matriarch with her 30 years of meditation experience, and I've known Quilly for, what, 3-4 years now, and I've never seen her more in her power and her just her presence and all her wisdom to come out. So Quilly was very much the champion of, no, this has to be a silent retreat. And there was a bit of grumbling. There was a bit of like, oh, you know, here and there. But it was beautiful. And it was empowering and in training for us all, including the facilitators, to be in the presence of that silence and what it engendered with the participants to reinforce, as Eugene said, that state of mind. So it wasn't just any peak experience with the medicine. It wasn't even a peak experience with meditating. It was the entire day for 5 days with the rise and fall and noticing where you want to go and speak to someone or noticing how it might come bring out the mind and just entraining that repetition just to be present, just to sublimate again. So I'd love Quilly to add to that.
We did actually allow, we had a teacher meeting with everybody every day, so they met with one of us to discuss what their practice was going like, what was coming up for them, what they were noticing, what they might be feeling as a barrier. But I know as soon as you start to engage, like Eugene was describing, you know, I got to get my Quilly face on, my Quilly persona, all of that Quilliness has to come forward just so I say hi, you know, and I think being able, as you let that go, it's, you don't notice it leaving exactly, but I think to a person, every single person said how valuable that silence was, because it allows you to put down and forget how you look. You know, it's not about that. You forget about that. And so what can come up is all of the aspects of yourself that are preventing you from full awakening. One way of describing full awakening as a human being is not what you get, but what you let go of. You know, that you're just able to just appropriately respond to whatever is in front of you. And, you know, that's what I aspire to. And I do pretty well, you know, if the fire is coming down my street toward my house, I probably will get pretty reactive. But the shifting from reacting to responding is pretty major shift in that. I mean, if I'm reacting to something, I really notice it. And in the silence, when you feel that, like we had this one little glitch in the retreat where there was a couple roommate situation where there was a little difficulty. And, you know, those things can get really big. So you can see them really clearly. You can see what's happening with yourself. You can see yourself blame this person. You can see this history arise, you know? So it's really valuable to just be quiet.
Yeah. I'd like to maybe just ask a question to Eugene and Quilly as well on what maybe the differences between the participants who identified maybe as a meditator or maybe a psychonaut, and maybe they have a bit of both, but what the benefits are for both different demographics perhaps.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I've meditated with a lot of I teach meditation and I have a meditation group. And there's been members in my group that have meditated for over 10 years or 12 years with me, but have never broken through, never had that samadhi experience. And sometimes I talk about it as if everybody knows about it. But even with a meditation practice, a lot of people have not had that experience. And then on the other hand, I know a lot of psychonauts who have broken through many times and have lots of experiences, but have never actually grounded the experience into an embodied presence, into embodied awareness. So this is where the confluence or the meeting point comes in. Another thing I wanted to really kind of mention is that, and this is back to the Buddhist training that Quilly talks about, is that it's not about chasing states, right? States have a beginning and an end, right? If we're just chasing the bliss and pushing away the pain, we're still stuck in duality. We are still, in a certain sense, suffering. What we're really interested in is not the high states, but in the awareness that's having those experiences. What is it in us that has suffering, that has bliss, right? There's a deeper place. There is that changeless, that which is not a state, but is basically the witness of all states that I find more interesting, right? Because yeah, it's great to have a blissful experience, but those don't last. But if you can really learn to access the ground of your being, that witnessing capacity that is the witness to the pain and the pleasure, what is that witness? And what we find is that as we turn towards that witness, that witnessing awareness, that's the freedom, that's the peace, that is the source of all being. And then once you rest in that, then duality just falls away. Now, when your client talked about, is it boring, right? Only the human mind gets bored. If you're resting in that pure awareness, boredom it's just another concept. It's just another construct, right? Just like birth and death are only constructs when you are resting in this spaciousness.
What was that original question about the meditation? There was some...
Well, what are the benefits or the drawbacks if you're a meditator doing medicine or you're a psychonaut meditating?
Well, that's where I started, actually. I think I changed the application a little bit this time so that there's a question about meditation retreats to bring awareness, because it's very different to meditate for a half an hour every day for 10 years. You don't really allow yourself to go into the spaciousness where the thoughts can be gone. And even in a short retreat like I just did, it was like you can easily get to a place where you can tell there's some things that could arise. There's thoughts down here. I sort of call it my thought soup, but I have no idea what it is. It could rise, it could come, but it's not, because I'm in still silence. And if people have had that experience, which most people who do a retreat will have had that kind of an experience, then they're off and running. They've got a foundation for filtering the medicine experience and turning to the awareness instead of to the object. So a lot of people that meditate just are focusing on an object, on the breath, on the thought, on the even open awareness, you know, whatever arises. So I think to be able to have at least on the cushion taken to spaciousness is a really important thing too. And people who didn't have that, they would just be hitting the pen. Whenever the bell, between the bells, they were taking a lot of medicine. And still then they've been more active with the medicine in the aftermath as well as the people that I interviewed anyway. I don't know how Eugene's people were, but the meditators do really, they're interested in meditating and then seeing what the addition of the medicine and how much medicine to do. And the people who are just minor meditators, I don't mean that to sound insulting. It did kind of, but that don't meditate so much, then they want the experience that the meditation, that the medicine offers, because that takes them to that place.
I mean, that was one of the things, yeah, as you said, we did notice, is that, you know what they say about desire or aversion, it's still an ego reaction, and that you've got these very powerful pens, which, you know, we collect at the end, and we're making sure they're used appropriately in the right set and setting of the meditation ceremonies. But even within that, it's like there's like a maybe 15 minutes, I can't remember, half an hour target window, we're meditating for a stretch, and then the bell will go for the pens, and then people will go with the pens, and then you'll be watching them, and some of them will go for a little bit more for the pens. And then as the bell's about to go, as the bell goes, they'll go for a pen, that last little pen. And it's like, but the training and the awareness of awareness there is the desire, right? It's like, oh, we want to go back. We want to be there. We want. So again, the yamas and niyamas, clearing that energetic field, clearing that desire. You know, it's like even this comes up, you know, as it should, to be aware in yourself. Very, very indicative and very illuminating of these subtleties within our ego states, even as we do medicine or meditate.
I think then about the middle of the retreat, I suggested so notice what is it when you are reaching for the pen, notice the desire, like what's motivating you to take the pen. And when I would interview, I would ask that question, like, did you notice? And rarely did anyone notice. They would just do it. So learning to identify those places is an important thing.
The
beauty is that you can really kind of regulate. And also part of what we encourage people to is to ask, you know, access their own teacher, their own guru, their own inner mastery. And then to work with their own edge, because everybody's a little different. Everybody's nervous system and chemistry is a little different. So to learn how to work with their own edges was also part of the instruction. So we give them a little bit of flexibility there and allowed them to kind of work with that in terms of how much they felt they needed and how much, you know, was too much, et cetera. But to really notice the desire piece is I want, and to see their own desire system chasing the states, because the state, as we mentioned, is not the point. The point is to recognize the underlying awareness behind all states.
Well, I think that's a good place for us to kind of bring this to a place of conclusion, because I have in this moment a lot of desire to keep the conversation going. I have a lot more questions I want to ask you, but it just makes me think, you know what? We're going to have another conversation sometime, because I love you guys and I can't wait to talk more about all of this. But I do know that Rack is going to have to leave. So let's go ahead and let's talk about when is going to be the next retreat. How can people participate and what's the next steps?
So listeners can find us on bridgingheaven.com, and that's got the listing of what we're about and our program. The next retreat is the first week of January. Guys, I'll have to remember the dates. There's a retreat in January and then the retreat in July. We're getting a little bit more interest for July in the Northern Hemisphere summer. But if we get the critical mass together, we'll be going ahead in January. Also, what I'd like to suggest is one of the things that we've been learning ourselves from this retreat and putting into practice these exercises and this understanding of the marriage of the medicine and the meditation is how do we support people who come to our retreats? And also, is this something which can... maybe it's a brand that we're developing, but we're really interested in nurturing and developing the community. And so, you know, how can this get beyond us in a way that we can also titrate and control the ethics and the integrity of the model that we're developing? And so we are looking at the potential of maybe filming our satsangs and talks and also the yoga sequences and some meditation exercises, which would be then maybe a platform or an online platform that would be compatible with pens. The pens are their own issue. You know, that 5-MeO pens and the legality in the country that you live in is one of the key issues. What we also recognize is 5-MeO is hugely compatible, if not it's like identical, you know, in what it can do to the egoic consciousness. But there is also the potential for THC pens, you know, pens of relaxing the mind and doing the practice. So it's almost as if the marketplace and the legalities haven't really caught up with where we're at in regards to bringing these practices together. But we do see potentials in teaching the techniques and the platform that we can bring in a retreat to maybe a more distributed community out there online. So we're still looking at that and maybe doing some filming and capturing that type of teachings as well. But for the moment, yeah, the what we can do, you know, in a retreat setting over an extended 5-day period is a lot more vertical and deeper and bonding with the participants and with the one-on-one, you know, group and facilitator training. So we do encourage and invite people to come to a Bridging Heaven retreat at the Tandava Retreat Center in Mexico, which I've got to say was totally lush, upmarket, the most beautiful food, the most beautiful environment, the pool, the sauna there, the whole grounds and the whole package is really conducive to your well-being overall. So www.bridgingheaven.com is where to find us, and we hope to see you out there.
It's January 16th to the 23rd. So,
great. Thank you, Quilly. Well, thank you all so much. I feel like just speaking with all of you is kind of like sipping on a vape pen, because each of your contributions is just so rich and there's just so much there. And it's just a great joy to have this conversation with the three of you. And please give my love to Joel when you speak with him about our conversation today. And I applaud the work that you're doing. And yes, I look forward to more conversations and more of seeding that Samadhi Mesh network that Rack likes to speak about. But thank you all so much for your time.
Oh, blessings. Thank you for all you
thank
do,
you,
Martin.
Martin. Thank you.
For all you do, Martin.
Aloha.
All right. Everybody have a great night.